we're going to open the public session of the Due Process Oversight Committee. And the first item on the agenda is a review of the board's activities and a technical activities update from Henry Rees.
The Interpretations Committee. The first part of this paper, which is up to paragraph 35, just covers all of the due process decisions in the period, including all of the due process documents, standards and agenda decisions and exposure drafts, so that you can see all necessary steps were undertaken and completed. And then following that in paragraphs 42 to 46, provided some background information on other projects. There's no specific ask from you with this paper. I will take it largely as read, but maybe just highlight some particular aspects. So turning to page six, just highlighting the two projects on this page. I think when we last met in Munich, I think we were just about, I think the very next day actually, to publish the exposure draft of amendments to IFRS 17 to support its implementation. Since that time, we've been busy with outreach activities, talking to various stakeholders in various different countries, as you can see here. The comment period ended just short of 3 weeks ago, and the board will start to consider the feedback at its meeting next week, starting with a summary of all of the feedback from the outreach, and then in November, the more analysis of actually the feedback we got through the 120 comment letters that we have received. The feedback, I think, is in line with perhaps what we expected, which is people very much appreciated the process the board has gone through in listening to the concerns and challenges that stakeholders have been having with their implementation. But whilst many of the amendments are sort of supported, I think some of our stakeholders would like the board to go a bit further with some of those amendments and also perhaps revisit some of the topics the board originally considered last year and earlier this year, and which it decided not to make any amendments for. I think some stakeholders have said perhaps we should revisit some of those decisions. So we will be cracking on with that starting, as I said, in October and November. The next project I just wanted to highlight here was IBOR reform. This is our project, obviously, considering the financial reporting effects from ongoing market reforms of rates such as LIBOR. And really to flag that since our June meeting, the board has completed the first phase of this project and it issued some amendments to the financial instruments standards to address the uncertainties that are arising now, even before the reforms are enacted on hedge accounting. And the board sort of moved quickly with this, actually convened an extra board meeting in August and got the amendments out at the end of September. And as you can see, work is now well underway on the second phase, which is just going to be looking at the actual accounting issues that arise when people actually start to change their contracts as a result of these reforms. The next three projects on pages 7 to 9 of the report, primary financial statements.
Oh, pushing the wrong button. The board, when it acted in August on IBOR reform, did report to the DPOC that all the due process steps had been taken with respect to the phase one amendments. So we are complete in terms of the committee's work on that process, and we're now awaiting what happens in phase two.
Right. Okay. So I've highlighted primary financial statements, goodwill and impairment rate regulated activities. So three important projects that the board's been working on for some time. And really the main point to highlight was that in July, the board confirmed for all three of these projects that all necessary due process steps had been completed to put these projects into the balloting process and start the balloting process. So PFS will be an exposure draft due towards the end of this year. Goodwill and impairment of discussion paper in the early part of next year, and rate-regulated activities in the first half of next year, and exposure draft. I think we've discussed these projects and reported on them at previous meetings, so I think the only point I wanted to flag here was on rate-regulated activities, was just to highlight that in July, the board had a discussion about whether the consultation document should be a second discussion paper or an exposure draft. And as you can see from the paper, the board decided that it would be that the best way to proceed was with an exposure draft, given where the proposal now sufficiently well advanced, and that was the sort of best way of getting the feedback that the board is looking for. So then moving on to just some of the other projects on page 10, just to flag financial instruments with characteristics of equity. So this is our project looking at those financial instruments that have both the characteristics of liability and equity. We published a discussion paper last year. We've been considering the feedback to the discussion paper this year. And as you can see from here, the board has just recently decided how to proceed with this project, and it has decided to proceed to still try and meet the objectives of the discussion paper, to do that in a different way by focusing on making improvements to the existing requirements rather than articulating new principles and also improving existing disclosure requirements. So work is now underway, and the board will be discussing next month the scope of work to be done. And then there's just two more projects I just wanted to flag, just as points of interest, really, which is to note that the next post-implementation review work has now commenced on that. So that's the post-implementation review of our consolidation suite of standards. That's IFRS 10, 11, and 12. And also on page 11, to flag that the board has now started work on its five-yearly agenda consultation. So this will be something that we'll be reporting to you regularly on this project, as required under the due process handbook. And so this is about setting the board's work plan for the 2022 to 2026 period. And you can see we have to start now, and the staff are now undertaking outreach to sort of draw up the detailed list of potential projects to be included in a public request for information that we will be issuing in about a year's time. So just wanted to flag work started on that, and we'll be regularly reporting on the progress on that agenda consultation. And I think the rest of the paper then just highlights points of compliance and also details the changes to the work plan and updates on all of the various projects. So I'll pause there, Alan, for any questions.
Ross?
Thank you, Chairman. Skipping back a second, because the Chairman's eagle eye had not spotted my my hand up earlier. Henry, I noticed on page 8, goodwill and impairment, the proposal in there that an entity should present total equity before goodwill in its statement of financial position. And then there's the board was apparently fairly split on the issue of amortization. Given our responsibility of overall promoting financial stability, is there not some concern that if you start presenting equity before goodwill, you're going to alarm users of IFRS unnecessarily? And it just strikes me as fairly inconsistent to propose that and at the same time to say, well, I'm not really introducing amortization. Are you not introducing amortization by the back door? Is that a healthy way of approaching financial stability? It's a question not on the substance, but on the what I think is an inconsistency here, which I draw to your attention.
I had understood what the board was proposing here was really to improve the visibility of the recognized goodwill on the balance sheet, because actually goodwill can be an important component of sort of total net assets of a company. And what the board is trying to do is just sort of bring greater transparency and visibility into the goodwill that is on the balance sheet.
Oh, you have to keep your finger on it? Is this American technology? Okay. Jeez. Bosch, yeah. Well, anyway. Okay, yeah, they import everything here. This was my personal hobby horse, this disclosure proposal. And the idea was indeed to give the investor a second look at the balance sheet, not to be having a second look at the quality of goodwill on the balance sheet if the balance sheet without goodwill gave rise to concerns. And it's not to our task to falsely alarm investors, but it is our task to provide investors that make them fully aware of all the risks involved. And we have seen quite a couple of companies go under whose balance sheet without goodwill was quite worrisome. So I don't think this is a danger to financial stability. This poses a danger to financial stability. It also might cause the firms in question to take measures to bolster their balance sheet a little bit. Anyway, I'm not sure if this is going to be applauded around the world, this proposal. It is certainly not introducing amortization by the back door, because that's truly a separate proposal. But what actually gave me rise to what gave rise to this idea was knowing that there's a lot of automated investing going on, based solely on the balance sheet, what it looks like, and not making any distinction between tangible assets and intangible assets. So I thought this might be a good wake-up call for at least some investors.
Guillermo?
Thank you. I was just wondering about the phase two of the IBOR project, and if you could just tell us about the timing you have on that, and how that relates to the timing of the substitution of the rates. What are the dates where that substitution is supposed to happen, and when are we planning to actually finish the second stage of the IBOR, and how does that overlap with the regulatory issues?
I can comment on that if you like. The short answer is as quickly as we can get it done, because we know that it is time critical, like phase one was. So we actually, I believe, will start talking about that at this month's board meeting. I think the hope would be that we can get through the deliberations in a matter of months, a small number of months. It always makes me nervous when I make these predictions, but we'll be working to a tight timetable. I think the Due Process Oversight Committee should probably stand ready for a request for another shortened comment period because of timeliness. In terms of when is this occurring, the short answer is I think is some of it's already starting to happen, because what the project is looking at here is what are the accounting consequences where you have an existing contract and you actually change the rate that's used in that contract. So given that there's an ultimate objective of moving people off the old IBORs to new rates, there is already some change in rates occurring. But it's still, I think, to the frustration of regulators and others, quite a slow process. So I think we do still have time for the vast majority of what's going to happen, but we certainly can't muck around. We need to get onto it quickly, which is the plan.
Follow on the question is, now that the first phase is done, would that take into consideration everything that companies have to do before the new regulation comes in, or is there any other issue that is still lingering out there that might still be pending before the actual regulation changes?
The first phase that we've done addresses all of the issues that we identified that are issues that sort of are a consequence of knowing that the change is coming, but before it occurs. So as far as we're aware, we've dealt with what needs to be dealt with there. And so the second phase is when you actually change your contract, what's the accounting. So I think the feedback on phase one's been pretty positive.
Thank you. Teresa?
I want to ask in relation to agenda consultation, because that is forward-looking, and I have basically three questions. Given that it is a five-year rolling exercise, have there been any lessons learned from our last exercise that you are reflecting into the current outreach? The second question is, do the current outreach exercise, are they specific in scope, which is different from the kind of outreach that you do currently in relation to specific projects that you have mentioned? And the third is there any risk of overlap, or how does it work in practice? Thank you.
Thank you, Teresa. So in terms of your first question, the 5 years and what have we learned from the last agenda consultation, there were a couple of things that I think were pretty key. When we went into the last agenda consultation, we actually had a pretty heavy work plan with a number of projects underway. And what I believe the board found was that it was being pulled in too many directions and it was difficult to make timely progress on those projects. So at the time, they became more disciplined in establishing a research pipeline that would identify, here are some projects that are sort of on hold until the situation arises where board has capacity, stakeholders have capacity, it's a pressing matter that needs to be addressed. So we found that that has actually worked out pretty well, because when we look back at the goals that were established in the last agenda consultation, the board has actually accomplished almost everything that it had laid out. And the few things in the research pipeline that have not started yet, in fact, it's because we've taken on additional projects that hadn't been contemplated with the last agenda consultation. So things like the management commentary update, things like IBOR and the IFRS 17 amendments. So I think that discipline in what we add to the work plan was a key message that we need to continue. The other big thing that was a takeaway from the last agenda consultation was related to the proactive support of consistent application. That was a very key message that came through with the issuance of IFRS 9. 15, 16, and now 17. I think one of the things that we'll have to look at is, as we move past that, how does that shift the level of support? Presumably, we'll continue that heavy level of support, but as we move to a different phase of implementation, does that suggest some sort of differences? So those are the initial learnings, but I think as we get further along into the process and we hear more from our stakeholders, I'm sure we'll reflect other learnings as well. In terms of the outreach, the process that we are undertaking is very narrow at this point. It's primarily focused on our consultative groups, so the Global Preparers Forum, the CMAC, the Users Consultative Group, and ASAF. And really, what we're trying to do is just identify the narrow scope of, or not narrow scope, but the a list of projects that we can describe and define in the request for information so that we're all sort of speaking the same language. So if, for example, one stakeholder says, I want to add a project on intangibles, and another stakeholder says intangibles, making sure that they mean the same thing when they're saying intangibles, because one person could just mean a disclosure project, somebody else could say, I want to recognize it on balance sheet. So we're trying to identify the likely suspects that we think are out there, express it in a similar language so that we can get the best feedback for the board's deliberations. So this outreach is actually just very narrow to determine the information that goes into the request for information to get the best feedback subsequently. And so, yes, there is a little bit of overlap in terms of the project outreach that we do, but we're trying to be very targeted in what we do so that we don't overburden the system.
For the sake of time, I'm going to suggest that we view as read, as I hope they were, the reports on the annual review of consultative groups and the annual reporting protocol. The second in particular is pretty factual and technical, and the consultative group paper is in slightly revised format this year. It provides, I think, a more informative discussion of what those groups are and what they've done and what the evaluation process was. Members of this committee asked that staff develop some key performance indicators around how to evaluate consultative groups going forward. That work has not yet been completed, but my understanding from the staff is that a paper on that subject will be presented to the committee at the next meeting in February. So this report represents a product of some of the thinking, but not the final proposal on key performance indicators. And I guess I would just ask that on both of these, no specific committee action is required. If there are any questions, let's go through them. But otherwise, let's go ahead. I see Michelle, go ahead.
Is there a plan to consult other organizations to understand how they assess their effectiveness effectively? Other, like the BIS or other organizations, have large, similar processes, so that could be an interesting source. And the other point is also, I think that's a point I had made before, there's a lot of reference to the fact that members of this group are quite happy with the way the groups work, and I hope we don't see that as a the metric for, and I understand we're not.
Second point, well taken and noted. And I think we do and are going to try to do something about it.
Michelle, maybe I should pick that up with you to sort of see, which type of organization might be worthwhile to think about there. But thank you, yes.
Otherwise, okay, let's move on to education item, which is 1E, is that right?
Yeah. On 1E, this is the annual review of any educational material that we've produced, and it's really about confirming that those materials have received the appropriate level of review under the due process handbook. I think you'll recall from previous discussions here, we have to sort of take a principle-based approach to how we read the requirements of the current handbook, because they were written for materials from a different era, and of course that's something that we've been addressing in the review of the handbook. So the appendix to this paper lists the materials that have been done since we last did this review, and laid out the nature of those materials and the level of review that they received. And I suppose the question for the committee is does the DPOC agree, based on the information we've provided with you, that we've undertaken the appropriate level of review under the handbook?
Henry, one question for you in summarizing that discussion and asking the question, were there any, in going through the appendix, I did not see any, but I guess I'm looking for you to confirm that there weren't any kind of particularly close questions as to the interpolative process that you had to go through given the state of the current handbook? Comments, questions from the committee? Otherwise, I'll call the question. Is the committee prepared to agree that based on what we've got from Henry and in the appendix, we agree that the educational materials have been prepared in accordance with the handbook requirements. I guess for the sake of convenience, I'll ask if anyone has an objection to doing that. Hearing none, I will take that as agreed. And we will move on to our review of the comments and next steps, overview, and finalizing the amendments to the due process handbook. Richard, I think you and Sam and Henry are going to take us through this in some order. This agenda paper is 1F, A through whatever it is.
Yes, Sam will introduce the first few papers, and I will take you through the agenda decisions paper. Just to remind you that our intention is to get your views on most of the issues that were raised in the consultative process at this meeting, and then to have a further public call in early December to finalise the position on agenda decisions, because that is the most challenging of the papers and the one where we thought it would be appropriate to get your views on the direction of travel before we finalise. So that's how we see it. And Sam would start.
Thank you very much, Richard. So I'll start with agenda paper 1FA, which provides an overview of how we intend to finalise the amendments. So the exposure draft of the proposed amendments to the handbook was published for comment in April 2019 with a 90-day comment letter period, and that closed on the 29th of July. We received 53 comment letters. Many respondents agreed, subject to some concerns, with many of the proposed amendments to the handbook. However, it is important to note, as we've already discussed, the focus for respondents on the proposed amendments to the handbook related to agenda decisions. And as a result of that response, the staff have prepared the following papers for discussion at this meeting. So I'll briefly move on to agenda paper 1FB, which summarizes the feedback on the main areas of the proposed amendments except for agenda decisions, and explains the staff rationale for finalizing the amendments to the handbook in relation to those matters. Richard, as he's already mentioned, will move on to agenda paper 1FC, which provides an overview of the comments received on agenda decisions. And then I'll move on to agenda paper 1FD, which provides an overview and analysis of other comments received on the proposed amendments. So now looking at how our proposals for the papers for this meeting affects the timeline. So we will discuss the papers I've just highlighted today. And then later in the year, we propose that the ZPOC will have a public call to decide on the responses to the major comments and the substance of the handbook revisions relating to agenda decisions. Then after that call, and hopefully all being well, we'll begin to finalize the drafting of the handbook and, of course, liaise with DPOC members on that drafting. And then in Q1 of 2020, we will look to issue the final handbook. Just to remind you that this is in line with the deadline set by yourselves earlier in the year. Do we have any comments at this point? Very good. I shall move on to agenda paper 1FB, and as discussed, this analyses comments received and provides staff recommendations based on those comments for the proposed amendments relating to effects analysis, educational material, adding projects to the board's work plan, the IFRS taxonomy, and consequential amendments to the IFRS Foundation Constitution. So I'll start with effects analysis, and one of the main aspects of the proposed amendments sought to better reflect the board's current convention for analysing the effects and the recommendations made by the effects analysis consultative group. Most respondents supported the proposals relating to effects analysis. They appreciated the enhanced explanation of the board's approach to analysing the effects of an IFRS standard. However, some respondents raised some concerns and suggestions for improvements, and I'll start with comments relating to financial stability. The proposed amendments sought to clarify that the board may analyse how greater transparency in financial reporting as a result of standard setting is likely to affect financial stability. The proposed amendments clarify that the board will make this connection through its analysis of the effects process only where relevant. Some respondents disagreed with the proposed amendments in this area because they think that considering the effects on financial stability is beyond the board's remit. A few respondents stated that they think that it contradicts what is described as the objective of financial reporting in the conceptual framework. One respondent questioned if this was even moving beyond the board's constitutional responsibility to provide high quality, understandable, enforceable, and globally accepted financial reporting standards based upon clearly articulated principles. Some respondents state that there is a lack of clarity in the proposed amendments in this area because there is no definition or description of what the board's understanding of financial stability is. So the intention of the proposal was to acknowledge the connection between developing high-quality financial reporting standards and long-term financial stability. This notion derives from the IFRS Foundation's mission statement, which you can see in paragraph 13 of the paper. The proposed amendment was also intended to reflect the IFRS Foundation's membership of the Financial Stability Board and the role which financial reporting standards play in contributing to financial stability. This connection was also made by the Effects Analysis Consultative Group. The proposed amendments are not seeking to extend the board's remit. The reason that financial stability has been singled out over other notions in the mission statement, such as accountability or efficiency, is to reflect the board's work in recent years. A consideration of the effects on financial stability form part of the IFRS 17 effects analysis report. The DPOC, not to remind you of what you decided, but the DPOC were also cautious not to bind the board through the effects analysis process to consider financial stability every time it undertakes standard setting. The board may feel that it is useful for the understanding of the benefits that a new standard may bring to draw the connection between an increased level of transparency in financial reporting and financial stability. So as a result of this, and as a result of the comments we've received, the staff are recommending for the final amendments in this area to clarify the connection between greater transparency in financial reporting and financial stability, to explain in the feedback statement that will accompany the final amendments consideration of financial stability in the context of effects analysis does not override the conceptual framework or the IFRS Foundation's constitution, and also to clarify that the phrase where relevant is used to describe that the board may consider it useful to draw the connection between an increased level of transparency in financial reporting and financial stability in explaining to a broader stakeholder audience the benefits that a new standard may bring. I think it was probably an appropriate time for me to ask if there's any comments.
Guillermo?
I just want to mention that I think this point is really important, and I think the balance that you're suggesting here is the right one, so I absolutely endorse the proposal. And even though I understand the nature of some of the comments, and I think there's a reason for them to do them, I think this balance is the right one. And I absolutely agree on the fact that we should include the financial stability issue in the handbook as it is mentioned. So I just endorse the proposal.
Other comments on the financial stability point? Okay. I mean, I agree with Guillermo. I think the staff has struck the right balance here in terms of trying to get us to the right place. Go ahead, Sam.
Thank you very much. So I'll move on to looking at how some of the comments around the proposed amendments to the handbook, which sought to highlight that the process of assessing effects occurs throughout the standard setting process. Many respondents welcome the enhanced explanation provided. However, some respondents highlighted certain concerns. Firstly, on the process of analyzing the effects, one respondent explained that the proposed amendments do not clearly distinguish enough between the exposure draft stage and the finalization stage. The proposals in this area sought to capture how the board's analysis becomes more focused throughout the process, as the analysis of effects is further informed by additional stakeholder feedback and a more detailed analysis can therefore take place. However, the staff recognize that the drafting could be improved to distinguish between the type of analysis undertaken in the exposure draft stage of a project and the analysis undertaken when a new IFRS standard is issued. Do we have any comments on that particular point and recommendation?
questions? Sam, go ahead.
Thank you very much, Alan. So other matters highlighted by some respondents in which the staff do not feel additional amendments are required are analysed in paragraph 28 to 35 relating to effects analysis. And I think if everyone's happy with that, I can move on to educational material and our recommendations there.
I want to make one comment on this effects analysis for the Interpretations Committee. I think that we'll talk about agenda decisions later on, but where the Interpretations Committee is engaged in standard setting, I think that what we have said elsewhere in the handbook about standard setting applies. Where the Interpretations Committee is thinking about agenda decisions, the Interpretations Committee is prohibited from changing standards, and I think in a sense it's prohibited from bringing its own view of effects analysis into what is not the standard setting process, but is answering questions about what the standards say in the context of particular sets of facts. And so I think if we were to do anything in this area, we really would have to be very careful about how it links into agenda decisions. That's the only comment I would make. Want to go on to educational materials?
Thank you, Alan. Duly noted. So on educational material, the proposed amendments relating to it sought to update the handbook to recognize some of the newer materials being produced by the Foundation and to provide a logical review process involving board members. Most respondents were generally supportive of the proposed amendments. They welcomed the clarification that educational material cannot add or change the requirements in IFRS standards. However, some respondents did raise some matters to be considered in finalising the amendments. Firstly, questioning the difference between agenda decisions and educational material. A few respondents highlighted that the description of educational material could more clearly articulate the difference between this type of material and explanatory material that is found in many agenda decisions, and questioned why educational material, particularly when it refers to specific matters in a standard, should merit different due process requirements from an agenda decision. So, agenda decisions are first and foremost a formal decision not to undertake standard setting in response to a submitted question. That decision is exposed for comment to obtain feedback on the decision not to undertake standard setting and for any comment to be received on the on the explanatory material that accompanies them. Now, educational material that is published when the board thinks it would be helpful to explain the requirements in IFRS standards, this is typically undertaken in a more user-friendly style that can take multiple formats, for example, webcasts or articles. However, the staff think that the drafting in the final amendments can be amended to more clearly clarify the differences between agenda decisions and notably more specialised educational material. Some members from the regulatory community commented that the handbook described the decision process for determining which type of material to develop. The staff do continue to think that this is an area for which the board uses its judgment in determining whether to publish material and the nature of that material, and that the handbook should not constrain the board when it can publish information to assist the understanding of the requirements in its standards. A few respondents, typically national standard setters, proposed that it would be appropriate for more specialized educational material to have some form of external review before being published. The staff think that a requirement for educational material to be exposed for comment is unnecessary. Board-level review rather than public exposure of a document is an appropriate level of due process scrutiny, in our opinion, to ensure that educational material does not add or change the requirements of IFRS standards and is legitimate. And also that educational material is typically produced in the period before a standard becomes widely effective. This means that exposure is unlikely to provide meaningful input, and it would reduce the board's flexibility in being helpful and responsive. Moving on to a few other matters raised on the proposals related to educational material, which are analysed in paragraphs 48 to 55, I'll note one matter of importance that we consider will need some amendments in the final version of the handbook, and that is that we acknowledge the importance of considering the complexity of the underlying standard when determining the level of review required for educational material, and the staff think that we should reflect this in the final amendments. So our proposals relating to educational material are at the bottom of page 2 there, under question 2, and I'll pause for any further comment.
Guillermo?
I agree with the proposals, but one of the questions got me thinking, the issue is, should we have some type of process, even maybe an informal one, just to make sure that we don't put out some educational material that overlaps with something that the interpretations committee is looking at the moment that educational material is going out. The thing is, just to make sure that no one views the board trying to get out educational material, let me call it through the back door, when there's an argument being had in the interpretations committee. I don't know if I'm making myself understood. You're just making sure that the educational material is not used or is not viewed as being used as a substitute to an interpretations committee discussion that is being had at that particular time.
The reality is that we do that in practice anyway, because it's largely the same team of people who work on all of the support, whether it's the interpretations questions or it's other educational materials, and there's a lot of coordination in the technical leadership team. So I think we're actually paranoid about making sure we don't cut across things coming from the interpretation committee and in other places. So I think the reality is our processes address that.
It's a very squishy. I think we're considering a lot of things. It's much broader than just, if you like, the technical quality of those materials. I think we're considering, you know, the appropriateness of them in terms of, is this the right time to be issuing that type of material into the marketplace? Who should be involved in the review? All of those aspects. So I think we're covering, you know, the risks, that, which I think, are, you know, you're absolutely right to highlight those risks, but I think we're covering that off.
No other comments. Sam, what else do we have on this, the pre-agenda decision?
There we go. microphone malfunctioning. And there so I'll just briefly address our recommendations on some of the other matters in the proposed amendments, and I'll firstly discuss adding projects to the board's work plan. So the proposed amendments to the handbook in this area sought to streamline and make more logical the requirements regarding the consultation that must be undertaken before the board adds a new project to its work plan. The vast majority of respondents were supportive of the proposed amendments in this area. A few respondents raised some concerns, which are highlighted in paragraphs 57 to 59 of the paper. However, the staff think that the proposed amendments allow for the board to receive sufficient and timely input on its agenda from all stakeholders while avoiding the duplicative and potentially time-consuming process of the current handbook requirements. Therefore, we recommend finalising the proposals in this area subject only to minor drafting changes. I'll move on to the IFRS taxonomy due process and the proposed amendments to the handbook intended to specify the DPOC's role in overseeing the due process associated with the IFRS taxonomy content and to improve the clarity of the approval and review process associated with IFRS taxonomy updates. The vast majority of respondents were supportive of us in doing so. A few respondents noted a contradiction in the table, specifically on the sections that explain the approval and review processes in finalising IFRS taxonomy updates. The staff agree with these, this being highlighted, and will amend the table in the final amendments based on these comments. And finally, the consequential amendments relating to the IFRS Foundation Constitution in reference to the remit of the IFRS Advisory Council to reflect the IFRS account, Advisory Council's role and moving into strategic focus. Respondents were supportive of these proposed amendments, and as a result, the staff recommend finalising the amendments only subject to minor drafting amendments if necessary. That's me on Agenda Paper 1FB.
Thank you, Sam. Michelle?
The fact that for the Advisory Council, support to the trustees was in parentheses had any meaning. If I look at the third line on paragraph 64, it says to act as a strategic advisory body to the board.
In the actual amendment, we don't have the brackets, so I don't necessarily appreciate what they're trying to do in this situation, but yes. So the proposed amendments say the board and the trustees.
Okay. Thanks, Sam. We're going to turn to agenda decisions. I think, Richard, you're going to lead us through this. Before I turn the microphone over to Richard, just... unlike what we just went through, where I think we got a summary of the comments and also some reactions, some suggestions by the board as to the recommendations as to where we will go, the purpose of the rest of this conversation is going to be to hear and discuss the comments, and the staff is not going to be giving us their views as to where we should go here, except perhaps coincidentally. And as we've previously agreed, there'll be another meeting, presumably sometime in December, telephonically, where we will take up the issue of recommendations with respect to agenda decisions. So, Richard, with that as prologue.
Hello, everybody. Yes, so you have in front of you really quite a long paper, 19 pages plus an appendix, which sets out the comments that we've received on agenda decisions and the key issues that we've taken away from those. I won't take you through every word of the 19 pages, but I will just take you through the key issues at the front of this paper. So you'll remember that there were three issues that we really focused on, and these were set out in paragraph one. Better to explain the objective and nature of explanatory material in agenda decision, to reflect in the handbook the need for an entity to have sufficient time to make changes to the accounting policies, and the prospect of providing an agenda decision power for the board as well as for the interpretations committee. Our view is that there is sufficient here that it's important to get your comments and thoughts now, and then we will have a call, as Alan said, we think in early December, where we will make some more firmer proposals.
Richard, maybe one additional point. I think in thinking about A, the objective nature of explanatory material in an agenda decision, I think A is a little bit broader. It really is also to decide whether the handbook should say something about the nature and consequences of agenda decisions. And I think that fairly has to be on people's mind when we talk about that subject, because it's really not just the nature of the explanatory material. It's what we want to leave our stakeholders with in terms of whether the handbook can say anything about consequences.
The focus of the handbook, as it says in the paper, is around the due process on the technical activities rather than the actual the status of agenda decisions under the standards, and we propose to focus on those issues. And in preparing for the next discussion, we will focus on three key areas, which of course are highlighted in the paper. First, how to improve the description of the handbook of explanatory materials in agenda decisions. This is in paragraph 5. Whether the incremental benefits of board agenda decisions justify the complexity that many people think they would introduce. In other words, should we actually have board agenda decisions, given the comments that we received, and whether there's a need to change the due process procedures for agenda decisions, in particular the voting requirements in the Interpretations Committee and the prospect of greater board involvement in the process. Now, we've set out in paragraph six the key issues that you might want to have regard to when you're going through this. First of all, the section on gender decisions, paragraphs 7 to 10 of the paper, set out respondents' comments. Few respondents disagree with the status under IS 8 of gender decisions, but many ask for greater clarity about that status in the handbook, and that's something that you might want to take into account when looking at this. Second, there's widespread support for communication about gender decisions, but there's a tension in the explanation proposed in paragraphs 8.4 and 8.5 of the handbook, and you'll need to have regard to this tension in finalising the revisions. Third, in the draft revisions to the handbook, explanatory material is characterised as providing new information, not as new information in itself. So this is very delicate, sensitive language that we've been using here, and again, this is an important issue. The deliberations of the committee and explanatory material are intended to provide insights that will help in understanding the standards. That distinction could usefully be clarified. We move then on to the detail of the paper. How do you want to play this? Do you want me to go through the detail of the paper, or should I pause now and see if this is a way to go?
Why don't we pause now and see if the question on this issue, which is maybe the most important set of issues in dealing with the gender. Michelle?
We want to get a sense of your views on the issues that have been brought in and whether those three issues that we want to focus on for the next stage are the right ones. That is clarification of the language, a decision. This is what we will provide in December. Clarification on the language around this because of that uncertainty. A proposal on whether we should continue with board agenda decisions, and a proposal on the degree of oversight that the board might apply and the voting decisions that the committee might make.
Question that should be answered,
and other comments or views on the analysis we've done. Any other comments or views on the analysis?
Yeah, I think. I mean, another way to put that, Michelle, is I think we're looking for, the staff in particular is looking for guidance as to where the focus should be in the proposed changes from the exposure draft. These are the comments, and we have not tried to edit the comments. The staff has not tried to edit the comments in presenting them, and so which of these is worthy of most of the staff's attention and most of our attention at our next meeting is, I think, one way I would think of characterizing what we're looking for here. Guillermo?
A question regarding this issue. So if I understand correctly, what your proposal here is to leave the handbook as it was drafted before consultation regarding the clarifications of what an agenda decision is. I just want to make sure that I understood correctly that your proposal here would be to leave the exposure draft as it is.
No, I don't think that's correct at all. Let me give you two things from the comment that I think cry out for changes from the exposure draft. Whether we decide to make them is up to us, but I think the comments suggest that we should reconsider them. And the two I'm thinking of is this question of new information and
some have read the exposure draft as suggesting that the agenda decisions constitute new, that there's information in the agenda decision that's not previously been available to the two stakeholders. I don't think that's permissible, actually. I think the Interpretations Committee is limited to what is already out there in making its references, but the draft doesn't accomplish articulating that very well, and so the question is, what, if anything, do we do about it? A second one would be this question about informative, persuasive information. Is that in the exposure draft? The comments suggest that that's not a terribly helpful articulation of what agenda decisions are for the people who are trying to use them. And so the question for the staff in the first instance and us in the second instance is, what, if anything, should we do about that? And so I think what we're trying to get here is some sense of, does the committee agree with what I just said? Not what should we do, but what are the issues that we should be addressing? That's correct. Larry, you have your...
I think the tough thing, Guillermo and Alan, is, as I understand it, we want to wait for the staff to come back with recommendations in terms of how to deal with the feedback received. So, and then we'll talk about it on a conference call to provide this committee's feedback on the staff's recommendations with how to deal with it, but not here, not now. But if you're looking for just really high-level input, my high-level input is that, you know, as the staff goes through the process of responding to the feedback, is that the ultimate mission is consistent application, so that we really have a global set of accounting standards. So as we work through this, you know, that's, I think, really key. The second high-level point I would make is, I read in some of the comment letters to question the whole terminology of agenda decisions, and I think that we should relook at that, not simply carry it over, because then we'll be carrying it over for another 5 years and just embed that term even more around the world. So we have an opportunity to change the terminology. I would suggest we take it, because agenda decisions really, you know, is that term doesn't really tell you, describe what an agenda decision is.
We asked the committee for its views. I mean, I think the decision not to come here with a set of recommendations at this meeting was, I think, motivated by two things. One is, there's a lot of very serious comment here, and we should neither give the appearance nor should there be the reality of any of these very serious comments being given short shrift. And the two-step process is designed partly to achieve that. The second thing is, frankly, the staff is looking for guidance from us as to the direction in which to go on some of these issues. I mean, and let me take Larry's point and turn it into a concrete question for the committee, because I think it may be the most important question we face. Larry points out quite correctly that there are two principal purposes of agenda decisions, in my view. One is to communicate that the decision that there won't be standard setting, and that was always the purpose, but there's been a more recently developed purpose, which is to use them to try to achieve more consistent application by providing more context in particular factual situations. For us to go further down that road would require us to say more explicitly in the handbook, and I think it's a, I think it's appropriate to say it in the handbook, although others on the committee can easily disagree, which is why it's a discussion point. What's the reaction to the proposition that one of the things the handbook should say about agenda decisions is that they proceed from information that's in the standards and in the basis for conclusion. They apply that information to a particular factual context, and they pronounce a conclusion under the circumstances of that particular financial, that particular factual context. To the extent consistent application is a primary objective here, the handbook could go on and say, if not just this is intended to be persuasive, but if you fall within those factual circumstances or things that are substantively indistinguishable from those factual circumstances, given the way the agenda decision proceeds from stuff that's already in the standards or already in the basis for conclusions, if you're situated within those factual circumstances, compliance with IFRS, in order to comply with IFRS, you have to follow the agenda decision. Not to put too fine a point on it, and we could say that in the handbook. It's a step that we have not taken so far. It's a step we didn't put in the exposure draft. We talked about persuasive information. What does the committee think about how it should ask the staff to think about that particular issue, which I think is, to Larry's point, maybe the most important thing on the table in front of us. Teresa?
I know that agenda decision has been a topic which has been debated a lot, and I've been really trying to understand it myself, but without succeeding, because I do think that there are a lot of words, and somehow we need to link them all up. I'm saying that there are explanatory material, there's new information, there is things that are helpful, informative and persuasive, there's non-mandatory and non-binding. The ones, I think that we need to start with some red lines, i.e. fundamental principle that ultimately we will not depart from, which is, if I understand it correctly, agenda decisions are not standards, and they cannot add to the standards, and they cannot change the standards. Effectively, that is the top, right? If I understand it correctly, is that the standards are sort of the supremo at the top, and agenda decisions deals with specific circumstances. And I think what Alan, you've been trying, and in, from my perspective, helpfully to explain, is the narrow question we have is whether identical facts embodied in an agenda decision will be binding on preparers. And I think that is something that, I don't know whether it's up to us to decide or whether this is, you have to total up how many pros and cons from the people that you have consulted, and whether in the scheme of things, in order to achieve consistency, which Larry is talking about, that it ought to.
I'm going to hand the microphone. Okay, I'm going to hand the microphone to Sue in just a moment, but there's no particular reason the handbook couldn't say something, but it is not the handbook that sets that your very top line principle that agenda decisions are not standards is already articulated in IAS 8. And so that is the starting point, whether it's articulated in the handbook or not. The question I asked is a variant is, are they nonetheless binding if you find yourself in the in factually indistinguishable circumstance? I mean, that's the question I asked. Sue?
Thanks. So in terms of I'm going to answer your question, but I'm going to give a little bit of context first, if that's all right. So when I read the letters, what struck me was what I think we need to look at when we come back to the committee is improving our articulation of what an agenda decision is. And that's because it's really important in the due process handbook to be clear what an agenda decision is and isn't, because it then determines what due process needs to apply to it. So if an agenda decision, and I agree with you, we probably need to look at the word. I'm not sure the agenda decision label is serving us particularly well, but let me just assume for the moment that's the name because it's the one we've got at the moment. What we didn't have until we went out with this draft in the due process handbook is a really strict sort of guideline on what's allowed to be in an agenda decision and what isn't. And I think one helpful idea that we've proposed in the handbook, but it's not clearly enough articulated yet based on the letters, is that an agenda decision is only allowed to repeat what's already in existence. So you get a question, and basically what an agenda decision does is to answer this question, you need to read paragraph this of this standard, paragraph 10 of this standard, and paragraph 43 of this standard, and pulling that all together, the conclusion is this. Now, even when we use the basis for conclusions, we're really, really careful only to say, and the basis for conclusions sort of confirms that, we don't even heavily rely on the basis. We're basically saying, these existing paragraphs say this, and therefore this is what the answer is. Because of that, it's not standard setting, because it's just repeating what's already in the standards. But firstly, we need to be really clear that's all that's allowed to go in an agenda decision. If we need to do more than that, we need to go down a standard setting route, and that's got a different due process attached to it. So the first thing we need to do is make sure the due process handbook is clear enough on which path you go down based on that criteria. But because of that, what that means is that, in a sense, the agenda decision automatically has the same status as one of our standards, because if all I have done it said, when you answer this question, read paragraph 10, paragraph 15, and paragraph 24 of an existing standard. If you have the, quote, same fact pattern, by definition, if you're complying with our standards, you must need to follow this agenda decision.
If that is the case, then the word persuasive should not be relevant, should not be appropriate.
The key thing we need to do for me is for the staff to look at what words should we put in the due process handbook that articulate in a way that other people understand what I just said in terms of what's allowed to be in an agenda decision. And Alan's question to us is, to you, is should we go the next step and say because of that content, to comply with IFRS, you need to comply with agenda decisions, which addresses Larry's consistent application point. Now, if I read these letters, there's lots of words in those letters and there's lots of emotion in these letters and people have different views about how we express it. But actually, most of the people whose letters, my read of their letters was, they want a mechanism to be able to help us tell the world that you have to apply these agenda decisions. It's a question of how best we articulate that. And I think that is what we're looking at. And sorry, just before I give up the mic, I think what you're really asking people for in this paper, looking at Sam, because Richard's not looking at me, is in paragraph 5 of this paper, you say this is what you're planning to bring back to be looked at. You really want to know if these are the things that the trustees, the Due Process Oversight Committee, agree should be focused on in the next paper that comes to them. Yeah.
Thank you, Sam.
Michelle?
I think for me there's, you know, there's a lot of confusion around terminology along the line of what Larry was saying. It seems to, I mean, for at the end of the day, what we're talking about here are interpretations. At least that's the way I see it. You know, we are interpreting a standard, and we, you know, we're providing a position in light of certain, you know, of how does the standard apply in a specific set of circumstances. That's the first part. The second part we're providing is basically a decision as to whether or not we need a new standard. So part of the problem here is that we have the same process for two things. And I'm wondering if, you know, we need to rethink whether or not we should separate those two. One, you know, is there a need for a new standard, or does this existing standard, you know, are sufficient to answer the question in front of us? That's one set of questions. And the other is simply, we have a standard and we need an interpretation on how does that standard apply in certain facts and circumstances. Once you make that, you know, separation, it becomes much simpler. And then the next question you have to resolve is basically, what is the implication of the interpretation? You know, as you said, is it mandatory or not? But I think to simplify this and separate those two decisions will make, you know, this process much clearer and much more transparent.
Can I maybe respond? I'm not sure you can separate that, because if you think about the committee's process, they get a question submitted to them. And so the first bit they have to figure out is, and this is the agenda decision, if you like, is do our standards provide an adequate basis to answer that question, or is standard setting necessary? So they answer that question, and then what we've gone on to do compared to the old days, in the old days we just stopped at that point, just said, there's an answer, go find it. We now give the world the benefit of the committee's reasoning and rationale, which is the explanatory material, and that explanatory material simply just explains essentially the process that you go through to apply our fresh standards to address that particular situation. So then, you know, and that's coming back to the comments that Sue was making, is that that's why these agenda decisions then have an authority, because they're just pulling on what are the requirements in IFRS standards to explain what you should do. But I mean, but the committee is sort of, there's a clear two-step process into the committee's blind reasoning. Some of the confusion to my mind that people were highlighting, and I understand this, is that they were struggling to reconcile the statement that said an agenda decision cannot change the requirements in IFRS standards. Probably agreed with that. But then we went on to say, but the agenda decision or the explanatory material in the agenda decision provides new information. And there were reasons why we used that terminology. They're very technical reasons, and I think what we need to do is sort of move away from that and try and better explain that the agenda decision, yes, it cannot change the requirements of the standards. If we need to do that, we need to do standard setting. What the agenda decision is doing is providing new insights about the application of IFRS standards. So I think we can help sort of resolve that confusion that we created. So that's one of the areas we need to work on.
Just in terms of context, because I think it might be helpful to share some of the sort of philosophy of what we're trying to do with the Due Process Oversight Committee, so you sort of understand at least where we're coming from in terms of what we're doing with the Interpretation Committee, maybe partly because if you violently disagree, it's probably good to know, but also if you do agree, then you'll sort of understand when you read the papers what it is we're trying to balance. So if I could do that, is that all right, Alan? So what we're trying to do is with this idea of consistent application, we're trying to help people improve their accounting over time and to try and make sure that over time we get more consistency in application. Now, we know it's not always easy, so our standards are not the easiest standards in the world to read. We'd be the first to admit it, and they have to be used by a whole range of stakeholders with really different levels of expertise and experience. So it's not uncommon that somebody with the best intention in the world can read our standards and come to the wrong answer. Now, often that's when we get questions coming to the committee, and the committee looks at it, and they're very, you know, very sophisticated users of our standards. They look at it and they say, look, because of these five paragraphs, this is what the answer should be. Now, we can have a lot of people who, with the best intention in the world, have got to a different answer, and we want them to change their accounting. Now, if we're not careful, because we say that this is just reading the current requirements, people can say, well, that means you've got an error, and then you've got all sorts of restatement risk and sort of punishment and negative sentiment that comes with that. So that's why we say, we know it's not that easy. So the fact that we've pulled these five paragraphs together to you, and, you know, very sophisticated people have done that, provides you with a new piece of information you didn't have yesterday, because I've helped you understand how to read the requirements. So that's why we talk about this idea of new information. It's new to you that we've pulled those full five paragraphs together out of the 3,000 paragraphs that you had to read, and so that's new information. So that's the first reason why we do it. And the second reason why we want to try and have this message of new information, even though it's based on the existing standards, is because we're trying to help everybody in the world apply our standards well and to encourage good performance rather than punish. And so that's why we're using this new information idea, why we're saying to people we think you should have sufficient time to do it, but we do want you to do it. And we're trying to balance getting consistent application with the reality of a complicated and difficult process involving 144 countries around the world. And it's trying to balance those things, which is making some of this a little bit complicated.
Guillermo? Sheila?
Just on that last point, I mean, I think the new information is confusing and probably wrong when you think about if you're just basing it on existing standards. So why can't you simply say that a modification or some whatever due to a decision is not considered an error? I mean, maybe just come out with that pronouncement. And that would help to clarify it. Because I understand where you're putting the new in so that it's not an error, but maybe just classify them that way. I don't know, is that possible?
That's one possibility. The only thing that we're sort of a little bit paranoid about, to be put all of our cards on the table, is that we don't want people to sort of willfully misapply the standards and then send a question into the committee and then hide behind the fact it came to the committee. So, yeah, so that, but that is sort of... Welcome to my world.
Maria Elena, do you have your card up?
Thank you, Alan. I just wanted to say that I believe that an official interpretation by an official body of the foundation should be obeyed. And I think we help the market by articulating that in the due process handbook. I guess it's going to be a step forward. The decision is based on the standards. It can only be based on the standards, but it looks at specific facts, and so that can bring new information and new guidance that's useful, and it clearly mandatory. That's my view.
Really trying to walk a fine line here. The original idea of the Interpretations Committee, let's avoid ending up like US GAAP with hundreds of interpretations and rules and specific around the standards, because that's what we want to avoid. So the original intention was agenda decision, no, we're not going to look at it. It's simple. Go figure it out. And then that was not...
We told
it was not helpful, so we started providing explanations. So the title agenda decision is completely wrong. The agenda decision is, no, we are not going to do anything about the standards. The standards are good. And then the second thing that we brought in was, we're going to explain to you how to read these the standards in the light of the circumstances that you have presented to us. So it's more an explanation, very close to educational material, not exactly the same, not the same origin, but in status-wise, about equal to educational material, and that's why we feel it's not mandatory. However, if your actions are not, or your accounting is not in compliance with this educational material, you can be sure you are not complying with the standards. And then what Sue says, we could make it very easy by saying, indeed, if you are not complying, then you are trespassing on the on the standards, and you have an error. Tough luck. Then it would be a bit easier to write down. But we are trying to walk this fine line here, and we still have not found the solution there. But I think, you know, so with this discussion, I think we're getting closer.
Gary?
Alan, just let me share career preparer out of the U.S. system. We're much more used to rules and stuff, but here's how, during the discussion of the agenda decision and its role, I looked at it and articulated it at the board meetings. First of all, I think as a preparer, if it's at the interpretations committee, it's already difficult and there's some ambiguity about how to waddle your way through our various standards. So if you start calling it an error, and I don't think we should, as a preparer, I would sit there and I would just dig in instantly and say it's not an error, the facts don't perfectly align, and the big four is in different places, and so on and so on, is how I would look at it. And then to question about how soon do you have to do it, and Sue had an excellent article several months ago on it, which I know is in the material here, is I would say if it came out on June 20th, then I've got a second quarter reporting date. And I would sit there and say, if I didn't want to do it or didn't understand it or was hard to do, you're back into arguing it doesn't apply, the facts are different, et cetera, et cetera. But then what you've, or it's immaterial, is the case may be, but then what you've done is you've locked yourself into a position that maybe it's not preferable the way the agenda decision has been articulated, but maybe it's at least acceptable. And I think collectively our job should make it easier, you know, for preparers and other constituents to apply our standards, and you got to look at it from that light. If you force a draconian early line, you're going to sit there and spend all your effort saying it doesn't apply, then you never do it. And so we're trying to enhance improvements over time, but that's sort of the group, the dynamics, you know, how preparers would see it. Sharing that for the committee's, you know, value for whatever it's worth.
Thanks, Gary. Teresa? Hey, Teresa, go ahead.
So our interpretation committee doesn't make interpretation decisions. In fact, what I was trying to say is maybe one way.
An agenda decision is not meant to be, strictly speaking, an interpretation. It's meant to be more direct than that. And the reason why we're careful with that choice of words is that one form of standard setting that the committee does, where they think that they need, where additional guidance is needed, is to officially write an interpretation, and that then has the status of an IFRS standard. So that's why we're very careful with the word interpretation, because it's got a particular meaning for the committee.
That is actually where the confusion, or what some of the confusion has arisen.
The wrong name.
Agenda decision, we should, this is just a practical suggestion, avoid the use of the word interpretation. Based on what you have explained to me, which is perfectly understandable, you're talking about the application of the standards to facts and circumstances. And the conclusion is that if the facts and circumstances are identical, then logically it should have a precedential effect. Maybe to minimize the use of words, you know, that are flying all over the place, like, you know, it's an interpretation or application. And I think in relation to agenda decisions, I think we are doing is applying the standards by pulling paragraph 3, paragraph 6, paragraph 46, and you go and work it all out. And then the new information, I think I can buy that. I think effectively you are giving guidance to the preparer to say, I'm not call it an error, but go and fix it.
Larry?
You know, the more you listen to this conversation, the more I think that what is even in the current handbook in terms of persuasive is perfectly fine. The problem is that when people, and I appreciate Sue's points about, you know, they, in good faith, they tried to do, it's complicated, expertise differs around the world, but in good faith, they may have gotten it wrong. And then, you know, someone brings this issue to the committee, they issue an agenda decision to say, no, you know, we appreciate you trying to get it right, but this is the right way to do it. And then they continue not to do it. Now you have bad faith. And I'm not sure we're going to solve this problem with, you know, changing persuasive to conclusive or some other word. But rather, you know, the root cause is, seems to me, you know, you have regulators around the world that are not doing their job. And, you know, maybe we need to talk to IOSCO to say, hey, you know, changing a couple of words here, setting expectations, et cetera, we're not going to solve the problem. You guys need to get your act together to help, you know, sort this out.
In that respect, I do think that using a word like conclusive rather than persuasive will help, because a regulator that says, well, you know, that's fine, these agenda decisions, but I don't agree, and by the way, it's not conclusive, it's not authoritative, I go my own way. That will become impossible. So the discussion will be easier.
Some of us, you know, who have a real interest, and some people are calling on us to, they're just highlighting words that can be effectively misused or misunderstood to create the impression that they're optional, and they're encouraging us to do a better job explaining this and use better words to convey all of the notion, to sort of saying, actually, if these, you know, if you've got a fact pattern that ties up with what's fact pattern in the agenda decision, then you have to apply those what the agenda decision says.
Guillermo?
From what I hear, I think we're converging on where the committee wants to go, and that's pretty clear. My only comment would be that this is a very contentious issue. So what I would say at this moment is, I don't know if we choose to go this road, whether we would want to see the final writing on this, and I don't know whether, even if that means going out late with our plans, that we have to go back with a new draft and ask again, because these are really contentious issues. So I think we're converging on what we need to do. But the thing is, we haven't told the world, and we haven't expressed that to the world before. So I would just say that we need, once we have the drafting, we need to discuss whether we need to go back and circulate that before our final conclusion.
I think we always have to look at whether there's a need to re-expose anything once we do a form of re-deliberation, and the Due Process Oversight Committee is no different to the board in that sense. I think the only thing I would flag, though, is I think we did get a lot of feedback, even though a lot of it was sort of unsolicited, in the comment letters in terms of people's thinking on whether what the sort of consequence or slash status of agenda decisions should be. So I think we should look carefully at what we've already heard to make that assessment.
Yeah, I think the right process there, Guillermo, and I haven't decided whether I agree with you or not yet, but the right process is let's figure out what we think the right answer is, and then let's decide whether or not we... Okay. Precious little time left, but this is actually... helpful discussion of the key issue. So
that's exactly what I was going to say. I mean, this has been hugely helpful. It really has. I've made a lot of comments that I think we can usefully pick up. This was the most challenging of the three issues. Remember, the other two I raised was whether or not we should have a board agenda decision power. Well, that's a yes/no, and we had a lot of comments saying perhaps no. And the third one is whether there should be greater oversight of this process by the board, and possibly whether there should be a change in voting in the committee. And those two issues, well, I think, unless you have strong views, I think there we can come back with some fairly clear proposals.
The only thing I'd say about the third one, it kind of follows from the discussion we've been having. Yeah. Move down a path of agenda decisions being more, practically compulsory if you fall within the box described by the agenda decision, that kind of answers the question as to whether or not there ought to be really the two of the questions on the table, one of which is by what vote should the Interpretations Committee act if it's doing something that is practically compulsory, and secondly, should there be sufficient board involvement, both such that we can substantively conclude that the board is on board, and equally importantly, that our stakeholders can understand that the board agrees with what's been concluded in the agenda decision. And so I think if you go down the first path that we've been, in a way that we've been talking about, it almost answers the last set of questions for you.
That we have sufficient guidance, as secretaries have said through the decades.
Perhaps we were not terribly articulate in telling you what we wanted or asking you but I think we've gotten it. Any other comments on the handbook?
We do have a final paper, which I can just go over very briefly on other matters raised.
Michelle? Teresa?
Thank you. We're going to
That's
do that now.
So I'll go over a paper, 1FD, briefly now. So this provides the DPOC with an overview and analysis of the other comments received on the proposed amendments to the handbook, which are summarized in a table in paragraph A1 there. And the staff recommend making amendments in two areas as a result of these comments. So firstly, relating to regular meetings with securities regulators. This is a drafting point, but we thought we should raise it because a number of people, notably from the regulatory community, would like the reference to regular meetings with securities regulators reinstated. In drafting, we maintain the sentence that the board maintains a regular dialogue with the securities regulators. We thought this covered it. However, given the specific responses, the staff proposed reinstating the sentence in the final amendments as was. And the second matter relates to the Interpretations Committee adding standard setting projects to the work plan. An organization representing regulators again highlighted the phrase, the Interpretations Committee adds a project to the standard setting agenda, which we use in paragraph 5.16 and elsewhere. And the respondent explains that this could be construed as the Interpretation Committee having the unilateral power to conduct standard setting. I think, based on what we've just discussed quite thoroughly, that's clearly not the case. The staff note that the Interpretations Committee may only recommend that the board develop a narrow scope amendment, but may assist in its development. Therefore, we recommend to amend the drafting in paragraph 5.16 and in similar paragraphs to clarify that the Interpretations Committee does not have the ability to change IFRS standards unilaterally. That's everything I had to raise from that paper. I'll take it as read.
Teresa?
In relation to one of the items that no amendment is proposed, that is the role of board advisors, I don't necessarily disagree with the conclusion, but I want to ask just a question for my own edification, as it were. Board members being assigned as advisors, on what basis, and is it part of their role as board members, or are they separately retained, and are they being, you know, remunerated in a different way in their role as advisors?
It's just, I mean, for each of the major projects, we will allocate three or four board members, existing board members, to just basically be a sounding board to the staff to help, basically to provide strategic advice, you know, help make sure that the right issues are coming to the board and things like that. And you know, I just strongly think that we don't need to say any more than the handbook.
Michelle?
I mean, in this last paper, was there any selection of topics that you decided to address? You know, I went back to some of the comment letters and some of the suggestions that were made were not necessarily picked up here. So can you clarify that?
So typically in this paper, it would be if more than one respondent actually raised the same issue. I think that's essentially the criteria that I used to pick up on things, and particularly if anybody responded to the other matters that we covered in the proposed amendments but asked no specific question about, which we highlight here, which is listed as Appendix A but as Appendix B. If any matters were raised about that, I was highlighting as well. Well, that's how I took it for the paper, yeah, correct.
Well, obviously, Michelle, just make sure that we've got covered before we sort of wrap up the project. And if there are any further sweeps, to pull up.
Absolutely. And we will use the call later in the year if we pick up any sweep issues to highlight that in the paper publicly, certainly.
Okay. One last item for our meeting. Richard, just confirm that there's no correspondence, or tell us if there is.
The last time I looked, there was none. That was no. Jenny's confirmed nothing's come through since last Friday.
No correspondence that the committee has to consider. Okay, I think we will close the public session with that.